Hey, this is ANC Report with Ryan Dawson. Today, I'm going to put up a program by Jeff Blankfort. Jeff Blankfort was at the Anti-APAC conference. We finally met in person this April, and I'm going to have him on the show shortly. But first, I would like to post this interview he did with Jamal Abdi on Obama, Congress, and the Iran negotiations.
My guest today on Takes on the World, Jamal Abdi, has been the policy director of the National Iranian American Council since November 2009, directing its efforts to monitor policies and legislation to educate and advocate on behalf of the Iranian-American community. He joined NAIC's team following his work in Congress as policy advisor to Washington State Democratic Representative Brian Baird. As one of a handful of Iranian-Americans on Capitol Hill, he has served as congressional advisor, liaison, expert on foreign affairs, immigration, and defense. Prior to that, he worked in his home state of Washington as a field organizer for Baird's election and coordinating and establishing grassroots campaigns in Seattle and Bellevue. He received his BA from the University of Washington, majoring in political science with a focus on international relations, which he's certainly involved with now. Jamal has written for the New York Times, CNN, Foreign Policy, The Hill, The Progressive, and blogs at the Huffington Post and www.naicinsight.com. He's a frequent guest on Al Jazeera, RT America, NPR, BBC, and Voice of America. We last spoke in November. Good to have you back on Takes on the World, Jamal Abdi.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, these are tough times. President Obama's decision to agree to minor modifications of the Corker-Menendez bill, rather than vetoing it, as he had promised, caught supporters of the nuclear negotiations with Iran, even his own press secretary, flat-footed. In retrospect, should we have expected this, given the withering attack on negotiations in the national media and from members of Congress, including his own party?
Well, I don't know if we should have expected this. I think what we maybe should have expected is that Congress was not going to be completely sidelined in this process. There was no way to keep Congress out of this process. And the hope that I think the administration had was that Congress could be prevented from weighing in at the outset when the deal is most vulnerable, and when the political pressures will be the greatest, to try to kill the deal. And I think the administration and, you know, groups supporting diplomacy and everybody who wants to see this deal actually happen wanted to make sure that Congress didn't take this politicized vote and make this snap judgment on what the deal actually includes, based not on substance, but on, you know, the nonsense that typically happens here in Washington and the fight between the president and congressional Republicans and the fight being led by Netanyahu against any deal with Iran. But that all being said, Congress was going to have to weigh in eventually. Congress would have to take action at some point to eventually make the deal, the sanctions relief under the deal, permanent. And I think the administration is maybe calculating that by making this compromise, they can actually buy Congress into this process, and instead of having to fend off Congress for, you know, the duration of this deal, they can actually have the body play a productive role. Now, it's a little pie in the sky for me, but we are where we are now.
Well, I know Prime Minister Rouhani has said, or President Rouhani has said, that he is not negotiating with Congress, but obviously this is being carefully watched in Iran, also by the hardliners in Iran, who see, understandably, that this whole operation is attack on Iran's sovereignty.
Right. Throughout these negotiations, there has been, first of all, a recognition by Iran and the United States that there are serious enemies of this process in their respective domestic political scenes. And I think that the Iranians are very cognizant of how problematic some folks in Congress can be and the significant interests that are opposed to any deal. And the United States is aware of all the pressures that Rouhani and his negotiators face, the hardliners and those forces who want to prevent this. And so they design these talks and they design this deal with a mind of not allowing those hardline elements to have a kill switch or have, you know, the ability to play a fatal role. And they wanted to design a deal that could at least initially circumvent those players. And that is now no longer the case. I think when Rouhani says, you know, we're negotiating with the United States as a state entity, we're not negotiating with individual branches of the United States government. I think that's a very accurate presentation of how these negotiations have proceeded, that they have had to necessarily proceed as the governments representing the countries at the table are the ones doing the negotiating, and hardline elements were going to be prevented from sabotaging this. And it also is accurate because we're not just dealing with, you know, Rouhani's negotiators and the U.S. negotiators. We're dealing with the other five countries who are at the negotiating table. And if every legislative body decides they need to weigh on this process, you're suddenly looking at already complicated negotiations becoming completely unwieldy. And it's not possible to negotiate anything in that way. So I think, you know, we would have the same, you know, in the United States, we would have the same response if Iran's parliament sought to intervene in the deal. And we would say, well, look, we're going to hold Iran accountable to the commitments they make at the negotiating table, and we're not going to negotiate with individual branches of their government.
Well, it's quite obvious that the U.S. Congress, when it comes to legislation or foreign policy concerning Israel, believes that the opinions of Germany, France, and Britain, its leading allies in the West, are inconsequential. They don't even, when they discuss negotiations, it's as if the United States alone is a negotiating partner with Iraq and giving away the store.
Yeah, I think that's true for some in Congress. And the real problem with that is that folks in Congress like to pat themselves on the back for passing these sanctions bills and in some cases forcing the administration's hand to implement increased sanctions on Iran. I think it's overstated that sanctions are what's responsible for these negotiations. That's, you know, the most simplistic possible view you could have of how Iran's decision-making works and the incentives and disincentives and the reason that these negotiations are happening. There's a lot more at play. But even accepting that premise, the only reason these sanctions have had an impact in Iran is not because the U.S. Congress passed them. It's because the rest of the world is actually implementing them. The United States has had a trade ban on Iran for 20 years. We haven't done business with Iran for that long. And according to, of all people, George W. Bush, the United States sanctioned itself out of having any leverage inside of Iran. So we really didn't have a lot of strings to pull, unless you want to talk about going to war with Iran, to be able to, you know, have leverage and to have the sanctions leverage over Iran. So really, what, as far as the sanctions are concerned, what really changed was that the Obama administration went around the world and convinced all these countries to adopt their own sanctions, and, you know, most notably got Asian countries who are consumers of Iranian oil, and they got the Europeans who were doing business with Iran to start to pull out of the country. And that was a form of leverage, but that wasn't because of Congress. That was because of diplomatic efforts. And so now when Congress thinks that we can just go it alone and we can flip the sanctions switch, turn the volume up to 11 unilaterally, they completely miss the fundamental dynamic of why the sanctions have been impactful. And I think that for some of these folks, they do understand that, but there are political incentives for opposing the president, for opposing any sort of diplomatic opening with Iran. And so you get a lot of these arguments that if you game it out a few steps, it doesn't actually add up to anything, but it sounds good. It's a good press clip, but it's not something that can actually be taken out into practice.
Well, one thing that I see repeated or everywhere from the Washington Beacon, the neocon journal, throwaway in Washington, to the editorial pages of the New Yorker, is a statement that Iran is a leading sponsor of world, or leading world sponsor of state terrorism, but they never give any evidence to prove that. And what it is to me is just a repetition of a big lie and a subtle way of attacking Iran because of its support for Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Right, right. I don't want to say that, you know, it is a complete, it's a complete lie that Iran is supporting those groups, and that it's not a concern. It's not something that the United States should be dealing with and consider as an interest. I do think that those terms are used in a vacuum, as if Iran is the one, is the problem in the region, and then all of our close friends and allies who are engaged in their own problematic activities and pouring money into groups, including terrorist groups, in order to solve or in order to engage in these proxy wars, and whether it's Syria or Yemen, that's not discussed. And so there is this sort of attempt to single out Iran as this is the one problematic actor, and then all of our allies we turn a blind eye to. And that's just not a serious approach to anything. I think what is more fundamentally the sentiment is that Iran is not on our team. You know, they give money to the wrong militias and terrorist groups, and that's notwithstanding the fact that Iran is, you know, right now pretty essential to the fight against ISIS. That is a key U.S. interest. So that scrambles that formulation. But bottom line, there is a rivalry between the United States and Iran. Iran is on the opposite side of the Saudis and the Israelis and some of the Persian Gulf states who are our traditional allies. And instead of talking about this in, you know, moralistic terms or signaling out Iran for sponsoring terrorism, I think this is really just about regional balance of power issues. And right now, the region, it is, in some respects, I mean, this is a little oversimplified, but it is divided between these two sides, the sort of the U.S.-supported countries and the Iranian so-called axis of resistance. And what the negotiations present is an opportunity to depart from that framework and to begin to talk about not how do we win this battle between the two sides, but how do we actually recognize that this battle is not actually benefiting anybody. I mean, it's benefiting some short-term political interests, and it's benefiting the arms sales to the region, and it's benefiting those who think that the United States should go around the region and dominate countries militarily and should be prepared to pour whatever, you know, money, resources, political capital, and lives that it takes in order to do that. But we've seen very clearly and most distinctly over the past 15 years how that has not benefited us, and it has not benefited stability or anybody who wants peace and you know, prosperity in the region. So I think that this is why these negotiations are so important, because now we're talking about going away from the zero-sum approach and going away from the, you know, the two sides fighting each other, but instead, how do we actually find diplomatic solutions to these issues? How do we find areas of overlapping interests where we can begin to start feeling each other out and say, you know what, here's where we agree, here's where we can work together, and then on those areas where we disagree, instead of fueling arms races and doubling down on proxy wars, can we begin to apply the diplomatic lessons from this nuclear exercise and apply them to the other issues at stake, whether it's, you know, the situation in Syria, the situation in Iraq, the situation even in Yemen, where you have this perceived proxy war. And so that's really what's at stake here. And anybody who is saying, well, we can't do this deal with Iran because they're the leading state sponsor of terrorism, the question is always, what is the alternative? And any time that alternative is presented, it always ends in a military conflict and a continuation of this strategy that was first really put into action in the early 2000s, where the United States is going to go around taking out taking out countries and planting our flag across the region. And we know that's not a strategy anybody wants to actually invest in any further.
My guess is Jamal Abdi of National Iranian American Council. We're talking about the ongoing negotiations with Iran and Congress's objection to them. One other thing that constantly comes up and is almost made acceptable to American public, as polls starting to show, is the idea, the statement, military option is not off the table. Just the other day, Ashton Carter, the new defense minister or defense secretary or offense secretary, spoke about the power of the U.S. bunker buster bombs, but they're not on the table. They're not going to be used at the moment, but they're not off the table. This is getting Americans ready to justify another war, which would be a violation of Geneva Accords, every Geneva agreements, everything else. There's actually no justification for U.S. war in Iran, but there wasn't in Iraq, and Americans seem to be being set up by the media members of Congress for such a outcome.
I think that phrase, I mean, you know, there are these phrases that dictate what we're allowed to say and what we're not allowed to say in Washington. And they are this sort of litmus test for, are you in the club of people who are allowed to have influence and dictate policy, or are you on the fringes and, you know, are you some kind of radical who can't be trusted because you don't think that we should go to war with a country of 80 million people and all that would entail? And so this all options on the table became one of those litmus test phrases. And I think it was much more prominent a few years ago around sort of the end of the Bush administration. That was the phrase that political candidates were asked to say in order to demonstrate that what their red lines were on Iran, and that at the end of the day, if it came down to it, they were willing to go to war. And I think it has become a substance-free phrase. I think it's something that, for better or worse, I mean, I think that some people may make the argument this is a bad thing, but I don't think anybody takes it seriously, because the American people do not want another war, and all the polling is very clear that you know, the population supports this diplomatic process and does not want a war, and politicians who talk about going to another war will not be rewarded, at least generally. Maybe they will be rewarded by certain powerful donors. But, you know, even the most hawkish politicians in Washington, with the exception of a handful, they will not say the alternative is war. They will say, well, the alternative is sanctions and you know, taking a tougher line. But very few of them will actually say, well, the alternative is sanctions, and then if that doesn't work, then we're going to go to war. All options on the table, though, it still gets trotted out. And I don't, you know, I wouldn't expect, for instance, I wouldn't expect the president to say, well, we don't have a military option, because, you know, we pay $600 billion a year for those military options. And I don't think that, I don't see people taking that option off the table. But in practice, by people who are not in Washington and people who don't follow this issue on a day-to-day basis, the notion that we would go to war with Iran is completely anathema to their interests and is completely opposed. And I think that anybody trying to push a war with Iran, especially right now when we're on the brink of this diplomatic success, are going to have a very tough time to do that. That being said, we have, you know, Obama's only in office for another couple years. Then we have a new president coming into town, and we've seen how powerful the bully pulpit can be for selling a war. And all it takes is, you know, this diplomatic process to fall apart, and you have some tripwire, you know, some some issue happens in the Persian Gulf or something happens to the remaining U.S. troops in the region, and very quickly you could see a campaign to maybe not go into all-out war with Iran, but to retaliate militarily, and that rapidly spirals out of control. And that's really the concern. The concern right now isn't that the U.S. necessarily, you know, calls up troops and decides to have a full military invasion of Iran right off the bat. It's that we can't control the escalatory process. And so if we don't have these negotiations in place, we go back to this cycle of escalation. And that cycle will be very hard to stop if it starts up again. And it's very hard to see how that cycle does not end up leading to an all-out military excursion.
It would not just be the bombing of Iran's nuclear facilities. It would not be limited to that, obviously. One of the questions, of course, is going to be already becoming an issue in the 2016 presidential election because there's pressure on Hillary Clinton to declare herself how she stands on this. And her spokesperson and major donor, Haim Saban, the Israeli-American, a media mogul who's one issue man, and the issue is Israel, told Israeli television station just the other day that he can't speak exactly what she says, but she will do everything that Israel wants her to do, essentially. And she has yet to make any statement in terms of these negotiations, which is kind of frightening because Republicans will be competing with each other to who loves Israel the most, as we always know.
I think that the statement that Saban made was, I mean, it was fairly general. He did try to imply that Hillary would adhere to the line taken by the Israeli government, and sort of the, you know, I think what some may think is the conventional wisdom in Israel that, you know, Iran can't be allowed to have a nuclear program. Although I think that's what the Netanyahu government is saying versus what the national security folks in Israel have been saying and what Israelis feel about this are not necessarily two separate things, but I think that this deal is going to be something that is largely accepted in Israel and recognized as at least better than what the status quo was. There will be opposition, but I think that the deal will be overall accepted. But when Saban says that, the question is, okay, so does that mean that Hillary is going to take a line that, you know, opposes the negotiations, or that attempts to take a harder line than the Obama administration as far as challenging Iran and, you know, potential military action? And I really just think that what he said was a reflection of what the political realities are here, which is that Hillary Clinton is going to sell this deal. I mean, I think she's going to line up behind it. I think that it's become very clear that this is now more of a partisan issue than a pro-Israel litmus test issue, these Iran negotiations. Netanyahu's speech has really driven a wedge into that framing of the issue because a lot of Democrats view that as a partisan move, and it sort of expanded the space for Democrats to be able to say, you know what, this isn't a question of whether I'm pro-Israel or not. It's a question of whether I support our president or not, or whether I'm, you know, going to allow Republicans to beat me up over this issue or not. And so, Obama's going to sell this deal as being good for Israel. Hillary Clinton will sell it as being good for Israel. And that's just a reflection of, I think, what the political realities are. But if you get into the actual details, sure, some of the Republican presidential candidates are going to say this is bad for Israel and we need to be doing exactly what the Netanyahu government tells us. And that is what is the deciding factor of what's pro-Israel or not. Whereas I think Clinton will say, well, no, this is actually, and credibly will say, well, no, this deal actually is good for Israel if what's good for Israel is having a verifiable process in place where you ensure Iran doesn't get nuclear weapons. Isn't that the bottom line here? preventing an Iranian nuclear weapon, this deal does that. So it's a good deal for Israel. Really, I mean, the question of is this deal good for Israel or not doesn't come down to the silly questions that are going to be tossed around in the next few months and in the presidential campaign, but it's going to be a question of, you know, what comes after the deal? Is there actually an attempt to have more diplomacy and to potentially start to take care of some of these challenges in the region that have maybe preserved a status quo that Israeli political leaders see as favoring them, but which in the long term are not going to be good for Israel or anybody in the region, and it's sort of time for these issues to actually be resolved. And so I think that there's a lot of promise with what comes after the deal, a lot of promise of Iran being sort of brought into the fold and not necessarily, you know, in this binary role of challenging U.S. interest versus Iranian interest and all these things. But that's really what's going to be the key here. What comes after the deal? Is there more diplomacy? Is there an attempt to actually bring Iran into the fold? Is there an attempt to resolve some of these longstanding issues in the region that threaten everybody? Or is there a risk that there is not more diplomacy? And while Iran is, you know, it does not get a nuclear weapon, at the same time, Iran does become stronger and is still, you know, there's a competition between the two sides, and that would be bad, I think, for everybody involved, including Iran, including Israel, including the United States.
Well, in the you put out a paper, the statement from the NAIC opposing the compromise amendment 615. We should take a look. What is the problem with that legislation as you see it? And can it end up sabotaging the deal? Or not can it, can, but is, what are the likelihoods of it doing that?
Yeah, there are a lot of different areas of this legislation to where we need to evaluate what its impact is going to be. So there's sort of the domestic political implications. Does this legislation give Congress the power to kill a deal based on politics rather than substance? And I think on that question, it certainly gives Congress new tools to potentially kill a deal. And it would queue up a vote for Congress within 30 days of a deal, where Congress would decide whether they're going to vote the deal up or vote the deal down. And that, to me, is not going to be a vote, unfortunately, based on substance. It's going to be a vote that mimics what we saw in the immediate aftermath of the interim deal. You know, the deal that structured these talks that was struck with Iran in November 2013, in which Iran rolled back its nuclear program, accepted certain restrictions, and was, in exchange, had certain sanctions eased. And that deal was roundly rejected by many Republicans in Congress, even, you know, some Democrats in Congress. If there was a vote on that deal based on public statements by members of Congress, it probably would have failed. And so we would have never had the interim deal, which now, you know, a year later, those very same people who were saying it was a bad deal are now saying we should keep that deal because it was so good, and we should actually not move on to a permanent deal, but we should take the interim deal and make that permanent because it's so beneficial. Even you know, some of Netanyahu's own people are saying that, and they were you know, criticizing that deal and said it was the worst thing in the world. So I think that dictates, you know, if you're making snap decisions on these things and you're making them based on politics and sort of status quo understandings of what's good and what's bad vis-a-vis Iran, that could lead to a very bad vote. And so that's the concern. Now, I think that the president has tools as well to be able to prevent Congress from really sabotaging the deal. But it remains to be seen. I mean, the president may have the ability to take sort of extraordinary measures to make sure that if Congress voted the deal down, first of all, he could veto it and potentially be able to sustain that veto through support from enough members of Congress, either in the House or the Senate or both. And then if he's unable to sustain the veto, potentially there are other ways that he can try to protect the deal from being destroyed, although I think it would be a very bad position to be in. If there is a deal and Congress votes it down, that doesn't mean that the deal is, you know, it's just made invalid, and we all say, well, we tried, and we all go home. It means that the U.S. would violate the deal. And it doesn't mean just that the U.S. would renege on its commitment made in talks with Iran, but also commitments that it made with our closest European allies, as well as the Russians and the Chinese. So this would be a very, very dangerous situation to be in. This would, tarnish U.S. credibility, but it would also give Iran a very strong hand to be able to unravel the sanctions and not be bound by any of the restrictions under the deal. So that Iran could potentially say, well, okay, the U.S. is blocking the sanctions relief. They're violating the deal. So we are obviously not going to uphold our terms of the deal. And we're going to go to the Europeans and say, look, we're not the party that caused this to fall apart. The U.S. is. And so let's start doing business again. Let's, these sanctions are just a tool that can never be lifted because the U.S. Congress is committed to enmity between our countries. And so European interests shouldn't suffer because the U.S. Congress thinks that they know better than everybody else does and is willing to violate its commitments. So, I'm fairly confident that even if Congress takes that vote, at the very least, the president can manage to get the support of enough members of Congress to uphold a veto. What I'm more concerned about is the effect that giving Congress these powers will have at the negotiations. This impact on both what the Iranians are going to be able to ask for as a result. I think this strengthens the Iranian negotiating hand, which, might be good for Iran, might also be bad for the United States, and might be bad for a deal because if it ends up being an unbalanced deal that can't be sold, then, to various domestic constituencies in the United States and potentially elsewhere, then we don't get a deal. And so this does give Iran a new, stronger negotiating hand to be able to say, well, look, if there's uncertainty that the U.S. Congress is actually going to honor this deal, if there's uncertainty that we can actually count on this deal being implemented, then we need some sort of, we need more in exchange for signing on to the deal. It's just like, applying for a loan or a home mortgage. If you have bad credit, if there's uncertainty as to your ability to uphold the terms of the agreement, you end up having to pay more. And that's what this could potentially have. That's the effect this could potentially have on the talks. The other issue is that this could directly interfere with the implementation schedule being negotiated for a deal. So after the framework was announced a few weeks ago, the immediate issues and vulnerabilities that were raised did not concern necessarily the nuclear commitments that were made. I mean, there is some question as to how the inspections will look, how we will make sure that if there is, some problematic activity that the IAEA thinks is happening at a military facility, how is the IAEA able to get access to that facility? And I think that's something that's going to have to be hammered out. It's a serious question. But the main issue that arose was the sanctions relief. On what schedule are the sanctions going to be relieved? And this is a real liability for the Iranians because they need to be able to say, particularly Rouhani and his negotiators, need to be able to say to the Iranian the Iranian people, the population broadly, as well as to some of the, hardline critics of a deal, as well as the supreme leader, that this is a good deal for Iran. And they need to be able to demonstrate that by showing the benefits, by showing the practical effect of sanctions relief. The problem with this bill is that it delays that sanctions relief. It will delay it by at least 30 days. It puts it in jeopardy, and it really represents Congress directly interfering with the schedule that's outlined in the deal and further complicating things by having 535 members of Congress now involved in these seven-party negotiations over this very sensitive issue of how do you relieve sanctions. And so I'm worried that this does send a bad signal to Iran. It makes the Iranian negotiators' job harder to sell the deal at home and to convince the Supreme Leader that they should move forward with this deal. So it limits their flexibility while at the same time strengthens their hand insofar as it enables them to say, well, look, we now need more because there is concern that you're not going to be able to perform on your side of the deal.
It doesn't look like a rosy picture from this perspective. From my perspective, it seems that the likelihood, particularly in an election year with our members of Congress, fishing for political donations, particularly on the Republican side, but particularly on the Republican side and the majority of both houses, that the likelihood of any Republican speaking up and supporting the deal seems very slim, given that their president is clearly not Obama, but Netanyahu. This is actually, to bring this up at the very last moment, it's probably not fair, because we just have a minute or so to go. But are you optimistic, or are you keeping your fingers crossed?
I'm still optimistic. No matter what games are played by Congress or, in any of the countries, whatever, domestic political games are being played, all of that is problematic. But at the end of the day, we got a framework deal. We got Iran and the United States and the other P5+1 countries to actually agree to something. And I think that the major issues have now been resolved. The countries are committed to finalizing this deal. And a couple years ago, this would have been unimaginable. The paradigm of the past 3.5 decades has been challenged. The notion that we cannot talk to Iran, we cannot come to an agreement, it's been punctured. And that, to me, was always the most difficult task, and that has now been achieved. There's very difficult work that lies ahead. Obviously, we're not quite at the finish line yet, and there's going to be a lot of white noise and attempts to try to derail this, but I still think that diplomacy is winning.
A positive note, I want to thank you, Jamal Abdi, from the National Iranian American Council. That's www.niaccouncil.org. Thank you very much for coming on Takes on the World today and trying to explain this very complicated, very important issue.
Thank you.
Take
My
care.
Pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.